Welcome to eSype's Global Economy Podcast. My name is Fredrik Eriksson, and today I'm talking to Roderick Abbott. Rod has had a long and distinguished career in European and multilateral trade policy and is now a senior advisor here at eSype. He has been the Deputy Director General for Trade at the European Commission and the EU Ambassador to the World Trade Organization in Geneva. His final position before he retired from civil service was the Deputy Director General at the WTO. And there he oversaw, among other things, the dispute settlement system. And that's also where we're going to start our conversation today. Rod, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much.
So, shortly before Christmas, we had a situation in the World Trade Organization where finally became clear that it was impossible to appoint new judges to the dispute settlement system, meaning that we no longer have a functioning appellate body at the WTO. What do you say, Rod? Is this sort of a death knell for having a functioning dispute settlement system at the WTO?
Well, observers vary whether it's a death knell right now or whether it's coming across the horizon soon, in the sense that you've got a system which was based on certain principles and then had a two-stage process. And the second stage has now been eliminated. And the question then is whether the first stage on its own can carry the system as a whole. And there are doubts about that, because in the first stage, if the parties don't agree, they have until now had a right of appeal, which they used frequently. In future, they will have no appeal mechanism, and therefore, if they can't move on, the report will never be adopted and become case law. So I think it's likely that that will happen, especially in the case of major, major disputes between United States, China, and the EU, for example, because they have a track record of not always accepting things, but always wanting to appeal. So I think it is quite likely that we are seeing the end of the system. At very least, we have a hiatus, which will go until the next ministerial in Kazakhstan.
Let's get back to the future in a while. Before we get there, I'd like to talk about sort of the history and how we ended up here. The dispute settlement system, as we know it, isn't that very old. Having sort of a big reform of it during the Uruguay round, when we ended up creating the World Trade Organization. Ever since then, we believed that we had a strong legal backbone in the multilateral trading system that would help to diffuse passions and frictions in international trade. So how did we move from that triumphalist, jubilant atmosphere at the end of the Uruguay round, when we expanded into the WTO and created this new sort of legal backbone? How did we get from there to now? What has changed so fundamentally that we now cannot even appoint judges to an appellate body?
Ah, I thought you were going to ask me about the beginning. And I can talk about that as well, because, as you know, I'm doing research into some of the origins of the Treaty of Rome and the GATT's reception of that. And there's a very good book about GATT and law, which is largely about dispute settlement, by Gabriel Marceau, in which there are lots of contributions from people who either were alive at the beginning or at least in the 50s. Now, what has come out of that is that there were disputes already in 1948, 1949, 1950. They were handled rather more ad hoc and much more politically, with compromises rather than judicially. But that sort of merged, gradually transformed into the current sort of system, with a panel of, if you like, peer panel, chosen from basically from delegates in Geneva. There was not an appeal system at that stage. That came in 1995. So this is something that has a long history to it. we started to codify it in the Tokyo round, and we then got an agreement in the Uruguay round, and now we have what's the current system in as it's applied in WTO. Now, your question was, what has changed since 95? I think the big change is that we have now international rules on goods, as we had before, but we also have agreement on services in the GATS, plus intellectual property rules in the TRIPS. Now, the TRIPS is perhaps not so central, but the GATS is absolutely central, because with services, you are dealing with the domestic measures of various kinds, and therefore you're no longer just dealing with measures across the border. And the classical cases that people quote are the TBT and the Technical Barriers to Trade Agreement, and the SPS, which is the Sanitary Phytosanitary Agreement, where you are very much dealing with the question of what should be handled and controlled multilaterally and what should be left to individual countries to set their own standard. So I think that's the big thing that has changed. The result of this, you are now looking much more at domestic measures rather than cross-border, is that you have the growth of civil society, the kind of up from the roots movement, where people have a lot of activists and lobbyists, but usually on single issue items, like it could be health, or it could be education, or it could be climate change, or it could be environment. And these are not the classical components of free trade agreements, but they've become central, largely because of the focus now on domestic measures rather than cross-border measures.
So could one say that there is a relationship here between the more you expand trade agreement to include behind-the-border measures or to include sectors that are not trading across borders in the classic way, in the sense that we have a good that is crossing a border and sold to a consumer in another country. So when we expand trade agreements to include new flows, new patterns of trade, that also leads us into a situation where it's going to be far more difficult to actually keep a dispute settlement system.
Yes, I think you could more or less say that, although when you say if you expand world trade or the coverage of the rules, it might depend a little bit what you're expanding and in what direction. But the services, for example, the GATS, already does contain a different form of cross-border measures or cross-border movements, because you've got the famous four modes, where you either supply the service within the country, within the unit you're in, which would be, in my case, the EU, or you are doing it into another country and by establishment in that country. So there you do have a kind of equivalent thing to goods crossing a border. Now, if you then go to digital trade, that also can be supplied by one of these four modes, I guess. I haven't really gone into that. But it could be in other respects that you are expanding the coverage of international trade rules and facing other things to do with, you know, the technology of it. So whether what you said was as a generalization always true, or whether it's often true, I don't know.
At the same time, I think, can't you also make an argument which is basically along the lines of, you cannot simply have a legal system for dispute settlement when the negotiation function at the WTO isn't really working, because at least for some countries and some disputes, you may be more willing to accept a ruling from the appellate body if you know that there will be an opportunity to negotiate these matters in 1 year's time, in 2 years' time, in 5 years' time. But now we're also operating sort of in an atmosphere where no one really thinks that the WTO can be an effective body for negotiating new trade rules or reforms of trade rules. And as a consequence of that, we see far more friction around the existing rules.
Okay, well, I'm not convinced that these two things hang together. The trouble with the negotiating forum, which it is in trouble with the Doha Round being dead in the mortuary or in the cemetery, whatever, that is at least in large part, in my view, due to the fact that the members of WTO have split into two parts. One which continues to believe in eliminating trade barriers, increasing trade, and free and open markets, while the other is much more development-driven and going for a different focus, which it has its own quality, which is integrating all economies into the world order, into the global scene. Now, that obviously, with the collapse of the Doha Round, or the DDA, that also represents the two parties. The other part of this is, can you have a dispute settlement when people don't trust? And I think it gets more difficult because you're basically facing a split in the basic objectives of the organization. And that seems to me to be the thing you have to settle first, rather than a specific dispute. On the other hand, specific disputes demand attention because you're going to get, if you're not careful, you're going to get into a trade war, you're going to get into a retaliation, counter-retaliation, and that's obviously also bad for the system. Now, I don't see that a dispute settlement mechanism is impossible, but we may have to create something a bit different to what we've had, and there are some ideas running around as to how to, if you like, circumvent the situation which has been brought on us largely by the United States, who objected to various practices that the appellate body was following. And we'll see. These ideas could work, may work, or may not work.
And speaking about the United States, they were the country that refused to agree on the appointment of new judges now. And they have of course, also refused to accept nominees for appellate body positions in the past,
yep.
Even if they haven't gone so far as to basically block the entire system of new nominations.
Well, I think they have, actually.
In the past?
They have refused the extension of a term to a second term. They have refused new nominations. They refused to replace people who resigned, either because their term finished or they just resigned. I think that's blocking the system.
Yes, I think my point would rather be sort of that in the past they have accepted new candidates when they have thought that they are going to operate along the principles that they'd like to see being used in the dispute settlement system. But now we're basically at a point where they don't accept anything, right?
Yes, that's pretty much correct. I mean, they obviously for many years since 1995 until relatively recently didn't seem to have major difficulties. There were discussions during the Obama presidency, I think mainly between lawyers, about various defects that they saw, but it didn't get to any kind of crucial point until into the Trump presidency, when to begin with there was one reappointment or something like that which got through somehow. And then they started systematically to block.
And what's your impression? Is it that the United States now is intent on never agreeing on anything with the WTO now? That they are convinced, or at least that this administration is convinced, that it would be better for the United States if the WTO just went away, or if it was at least devoid of energy and capacity to intervene in U.S. political matters when they are adjudicating disputes at the WTO? Or do you think that they will be at some point open to ideas and proposals that may come from other countries of reforming the system in a way that at least is going to lead to new people coming into the appellate body?
Well, the honest answer is I don't know more than anyone else how this is going to play out. If you go back to sort of basic principles, the dispute settlement system under GATT, all the way through till 95, was basically more political and based on the old diplomatic idea of you go and you give and you get, and you make compromises. Some people call it concessions, but you make compromises and reach political solution. That, with the WTO, has become extremely judicial, extremely, I would say, even legalistic. You have only to see the sort of submissions that are submitted by lawyers on all sides, it's not only American, to see how legal it all has become. Now, if you consider this as a pendulum, it has gone from one end to the other, and if you believe in cycles, it could start coming back into the middle, and maybe it will. As to what the Americans want and would accept, I have no idea. They haven't been really very clear. At certain moments, you have the impression that parts of the Trump administration, because you have different streams, what Mr. Trump knows about WTO is one thing and is probably not very large. What Mr. Lighthizer knows about WTO is quite considerable, but he has a track record of certain things. The only area where you come to the kind of idea that you were saying about trust, and it's easier if you can feel that over 5 years you will achieve something new, the only area where that really has been true is the trade remedies area, where the whole idea of action against unfair trade, against subsidies, against dumping, is based on the feeling that you can take those measures, and the other side can move as well. You have a kind of equality of action possible. That's still a principle which could be followed if that's what the Americans wanted. But it's not very clear because they haven't really. They've been more clear what they don't like and want, and insist on changing. And you've got to. I've actually heard it said or written that the other members have to acknowledge that the whole system is broken before they will even talk. Now that's a pretty hard position.
It is a pretty hard position. So what are other countries doing in response to America's refusal to appoint new judges to the WTO appellate body? We've heard about an Ottawa group based on a ministerial that took place in Canada a few years ago, where at least a subset of the membership in the WTO met in order to discuss and possibly come up with ideas for reform. We've heard about the European Union presenting its own ideas to the membership of the WTO of how they can see different scenarios going forward on judicial reform. Mm. What have they proposed?
The beginning of this in the middle of 2018, I guess, was analytical. Both Canada and the EU followed a similar kind of analysis path, where they looked at what the functions, main functions of WTO were, and what would need to be reformed. And negotiating forum was one important function, rulemaking was another, and sort of day-to-day management and so forth was a third, and I think there was a fourth. Now, that analysis phase lasted until it became absolutely clear that the Americans were not going to engage on anything like that. They simply wanted change. And change on the appellate body, full stop. So at a later stage, I would say the reaction of other members was A, stunned astonishment, B, they set up a kind of traditional thing, which was to ask one trusted ambassador, who happened to be from New Zealand, I think, to consult with all members as to how they would want to work and so on. He produced eventually a report with recommendations, which the Americans shot even before it had taken off. So that hasn't got very far. The other thing that both the EU and Canada, in some cases almost on a joint basis, they have been pursuing the ideas of circumventing this, leaving the Americans on one side if they don't wish to belong. You could set up an alternative appeal system, which would be given some legitimacy by the fact that all the members who engage in it would accept the process. And that's a mirror to other things like constitutional amendments, where you often do that. You get an amendment which is valid only for all those who engage in it. At least we used to do that, perhaps, I should say, in the 1980s. I don't know whether it's happened since, because we've had perhaps a different kind of atmosphere. So they've tried to circumvent in that way. What has struck me is that the Americans have continued to oppose any kind of a solution, even though you've had statements made by the vast majority of members, up to 60 and 70 members, signing on to declarations that they want the system to continue, and the Americans have been totally impervious. So you come to a question eventually: do they want to stay in WTO? And then, of course, the question is: would the WTO survive without a major member?
So what's going to happen now? I mean, you mentioned that some countries are setting up their own system for having sort of an appellate body function.
Talking about it anyway.
At least talking about it. Mm. We have, also, as you also mentioned, we have a WTO ministerial coming up in Kazakhstan towards the end of the year, I think. And that, of course, is going to not be helped by the fact that there is a presidential election in the United States in November.
Well, I suppose that's true, but frankly, the two things are completely on different tracks. And whatever, I suppose it's true that what happens in Nur Sultan, which we used to call Astana, what happens there could be used as part of the American election process. That must be true, although, frankly, it's all extremely different. I don't know if we'll get any solution to this, unless somehow it is judged that Trump's electoral chances would be improved by having an agreement rather than having a standoff. At the moment, he's saying, I'm great and everyone else is silly. I'm standing up for America first and America great and so forth. And that seems to play very well with his voting base. Who knows? I mean, by then he may feel more comfortable. He may be prepared to do something. We can't tell. I'm not absolutely convinced. There is some kind of linkage between the two events, but I would hope that the ministerial would do some other work, perhaps in the area of WTO reform of other types, like negotiating forum, like updating the rules on subsidies, which is behind the scenes is one of the big problems, is the state financing of subsidies by China. So if they could make progress on that, possibly then America would feel that they could perhaps move slightly into the middle without losing face, if you like.
I was going to ask about that, and this is also going to be my final question. So we have a couple of concerns that we've noted from the American side, and they don't tend to be original in the sense that it's only United States that have these concerns. European Union tends to share them. We know that other countries as well have these problems. You mentioned state subsidies as one of them. I know there's also been a big discussion both in America and in Europe about special and differential treatment, whether it's fair or if it's a good way to have sort of a self-declaratory system where countries that today tend to be quite developed can define themselves as being a developing country, and as a consequence of that, they don't need to be covered by the same rules as other members.
Okay, well, I would say there are things where people do believe the rules have to change, like the Americans say, and there are things where they don't agree. And two things where they don't agree, I think, is special and differential treatment. We had a solution to that of long standing. It is self-designation, which may or may not be very fair. You have to have a bit more faith in the ability of countries to, you know, recognize where they are in the system. But nobody really was saying we absolutely have to change that until the Americans suddenly did that. The other thing that I think people don't agree with is the American obsession with the fact that the appellate body reports were sometimes delivered on the 91st day instead of on the 89th day. Nobody else had a problem with that. They simply tolerated, knowing that the actual date of delivery depended on things like public, things like printing and translation, which were out of the control of the appellate body. Okay, so for the other things, I think you could get a kind of working majority to do something about state finance subsidies. It depends on how far the Chinese would be willing to go into something that looks quite like regime change, not in the political sense, but in the trade sense. The state financing in China is absolutely sort of integrated into the whole economy. So it's a big ask, but maybe they would agree to, I don't know, set some cap to it, to set a cap on which levels of state financing you can do and which you can't. But it's tricky. I mean, obviously, you are aiming basically at one country, although you might be slightly aiming at Russia as well, despite what people say. And you know, you would have to be very delicate in pushing the Chinese along to some kind of and it might only be a sort of halfway sort of solution to begin with, but we do need to move, because the way that is operating right now is distorting the whole system. Now, of course, if you're talking about subsidies, distortion, etc., you should not forget the EU and the agricultural subsidies. This is much less of a problem than it used to be. It was widely discussed in the late lamented Doha round, and there were various cap kinds of solutions envisaged. Those could be rolled out again, and they might serve even as a kind of model for the Chinese. Who knows? So I think for Kazakhstan, for the ministerial, there are things that could be done. But whether you would get to any kind of real solution on the appeal process and dispute settlement, I think is sort of a moot point.
All right. Thank you very much, Rod, for a very good conversation.
It's my pleasure.